Chapter 58. Alchemy, however, is a chaste prostitute, who has many lovers, but disappoints all and grants her favors to none. She transforms the haughty into fools, the rich into paupers, the philosophers into dolts, and the deceived into loquacious deceivers. Tritemius, Analium Hirsaugensium, Tomi Duo, S. Gallo, 1690, 141. Suddenly the room was plunged into darkness and the walls lighted up. I realized that three-quarters of the wall space was a semicircular screen on which pictures were about to be projected. When these appeared, I became aware that a part of the ceiling and of the floor was made of reflecting material, as were some of the objects that had first struck me as cheap because of the tawdry way they sparkled: the sequins, the scales, a shield, some copper vases. We were immersed in a subaqueous world where images were multiplied, fragmented, fused with the shadows of those present. The floor reflected the ceiling the floor, and together they mirrored the figures that appeared on the screen. Along with the music, subtle odors spread through the room, first Indian incense, then others, less distinct, and sometimes disagreeable. At first the penumbra about us fell into absolute night. Then a grumbling was heard, a churning of lava, and we were in a crater, where dark and slimy matter bubbled up in the fitful light of yellow and bluish flames. Oily vapors rose, to descend again, condensing as dew or rain, and an odor of fetid earth drifted up, a stench of decay. I inhaled sepulchre, tartar, darkness. A poisonous liquid oozed around me, snaking between tongues of dung, humus, coal dust, mud, smoke, lead, scum, naphtha, a black blacker than black, which now paled to allow two reptiles to appear, one light blue, the other reddish, entwined in an embrace, each biting the other's tail, to form a single circle. It was as if I had drunk too much alcohol. I could no longer see my companions, who were lost in the shadows. I could not recognize the forms gliding past me, hazy, fluid outlines. Then I felt my hand grasped. I didn't turn, not wanting to discover that I had deceived myself, because I caught Lorenza's perfume, and only then did I realize how great was my desire for her. It must have been Lorenza. She had come to resume the dialogue of fingernails scraping on my door, to finish what she had left unfinished the night before. Sulfur and mercury joined in a wet warmth that made my groin throb, but without urgency. I was expecting the rebus, the androgynous youth, the philosopher's salt, the coronation of the work of the white. I seemed to know everything. All my reading of the past few months was perhaps now resurfacing in my mind, or perhaps Lorenza was transmitting the knowledge to me through the touch of her hand. Her palm was moist with sweat. I surprised myself by murmuring obscure names, names that the philosophers I knew had given to the white. With them, perhaps, I was calling Lorenza to me, or perhaps I was only repeating them to myself in a propitiatory litany. White copper, immaculate lamb, ibethest, alberach, blessed water, purified mercury, orpiment, azoc, bauroc, camber, caspa, cherry, wax, kea, chimerison, electron, Euphrates, Eve, fada, pavonius, foundation of the art, precious stone of Gavinus, diamond, Zebach, Ziva, Veil, Narcissus, Lily, Hermaphrodite, High, Hypostasis, Hyle, Virgin's Milk, Unique Stone, Full Moon, Mother, Living Oil, Legume, Egg, Phlegm, Point, Root, Salt of Nature, Leafy Earth, Tivas, Tinkar, Steam, Evening Star, Wind, Virago, Pharaoh's Glass, Baby's Urine, Vulture, Placenta, Menstruum, Fugitive Slave, Left Hand, Sperm of Metals, Spirit, Tin, Juice, Oil of Sulphur. In the pitch, now grayish, dark, an outline of rocks and withered trees, a black sun setting. Then an almost blinding light, and sparkling figures reflected everywhere, creating a kaleidoscopic effect. Now the smell was liturgical, churchly. My head ached. There was a weight on my brow. I saw a sumptuous hall lined with golden tapestries, perhaps a nuptial banquet, with a princely bridegroom and a bride in white, then an elderly king and queen enthroned, beside them a warrior and another king with dark skin. Before the dark king, a little altar on which a book was set, covered with black velvet, and a lighted candle in an ivory candlestick. Next to the candlestick, a rotating globe and a clock surmounted by a tiny crystal fountain from which a liquid flowed, blood red. Above the fountain was a skull. From an eye socket slid a white serpent. Lorenza was breathing words into my ear, but I couldn't hear her voice. The serpent moved to the rhythm of slow, sad music. The king and queen now wore black, and before them were six closed coffins. After a few measures of grim-faced tuba, a man in a black hood appeared. At first, in a hieratic performance, as if in slow motion, the king submitted with mournful joy, bowing his meek head. The hooded man raised an axe, and then the rapid slash of a pendulum, the blade multiplied in every reflecting surface, and the heads that rolled were 1,000. After this, the images succeeded one another, but I had difficulty following the story. I believe that all the characters in turn, including the Dark King, were decapitated and laid in the coffins. The whole room was transformed into the shore of a sea or lake, and we saw six vessels land, and the biers were carried aboard them. Then the vessels departed across the water, faded into the night. All this took place while the incense curled, almost palpable in dense fumes, and for a moment I feared I was among the condemned. Around me, many murmured, "The wedding, the wedding." Lorenza was gone. I turned to look for her among the shadows. The room was now a crypt or sumptuous tomb, its vault illuminated by a carbuncle of extraordinary size. In every corner, women appeared in virginal dress. They gathered around a cauldron 2 stories high, in a framework with a stone base and a portico like an oven. From twin towers emerged 2 alembics, emptying into an egg-shaped bowl. A third, central tower, ended in a fountain. Inside the base of the framework, the bodies of the decapitated were visible. One of the virginal women carried a box and drew from it a round object, which she placed in a niche of the central tower, and immediately the fountain at the top began to spurt. I had time to recognize the object. It was the head of the Moorish king, which now burned like a log, making the water of the fountain boil, fumes, puffs of steam, gurgling. Lorenza this time put her hand on the back of my neck, caressing it, as I had seen her caress Jacopo in the car. The woman brought a golden sphere, turned on a tap in the oven, and caused a thick red liquid to flow into the sphere. Then the sphere was opened, and in place of the red liquid it contained an egg, large, beautiful, white as snow. The woman took the egg out and set it on the ground in a pile of yellow sand. The egg opened, and a bird came out, still unformed and bloody. But, watered with the blood of the decapitated, it grew before our eyes, became handsome and radiant. They decapitated the bird and reduced it to ashes on a little altar. Some kneaded the ash into a paste, poured the thin paste into 2 molds, and set them in the oven to bake, blowing on the fire with some pipes. In the end, the molds were opened, and 2 pretty figures appeared, pale, almost transparent, a youth and a maiden, no more than 4 spans high, soft and fleshy as living creatures, but with eyes still glassy, mineral. They were set on 2 cushions, and an old man poured drops of blood into their mouths. Other women arrived, with golden trumpets decorated with green garlands. They handed a trumpet to the old man, who put it to the lips of the 2 creatures, still suspended in their vegetable lethargy, their sweet animal sleep, and he began to insufflate soul into their bodies. The room filled with light. The light dimmed to a half-light, then to a darkness broken by orange flashes. There was an immense dawn while the trumpets sounded, loud and ringing, and all was a dazzle of ruby. At that point I again lost Lorenza, and realized I would never find her. Everything turned a flaming red, which slowly dulled to indigo and violet, and the screen went blank. The pain in my forehead became intolerable. "Mysterio magnum," Allier said calmly at my side. "The rebirth of the new man through death and passion. A good performance, I must say, even if the taste for allegory perhaps marred the precision of the phases. What you saw was only a performance, but it spoke of a thing, and our host claims to have produced this thing. Come, let us go and see the miracle achieved." Chapter 59. And if such monsters are generated, we must believe them the work of nature, even if they be different from man. Paracelsus, De Homunculis, in Operum Volumen Secundum, Geneva, de Tourne, 1658, page 465. He led us out into the garden, and I felt better at once. I didn't dare ask the others if Lorenza had come after all. Probably I had dreamed it. After a few steps, we entered a greenhouse. The stifling heat dazed me. Among tropical plants were 6 glass ampules in the shape of pears, or tears, hermetically sealed, filled with a pale blue liquid. Inside each vessel floated a creature about 20 centimeters high. We recognized the gray-haired king, the queen, the moor, the warrior, and the 2 adolescents crowned with laurel, one blue and one pink. They swayed with a graceful swimming motion, as if water were their element. It was hard to determine whether they were models made of plastic or wax, or whether they were living beings. The slight opacity of the liquid made it impossible to tell if the faint pulse that animated them was an optical illusion or reality. "They seem to grow every day," Allier said. "Each morning the vessels are buried in fresh horse manure, still warm, which provides the heat necessary for growth. In Paracelsus there are prescriptions that say homunculi must be grown at the internal temperature of a horse. According to our host, these homunculi speak to him, tell him secrets, utter prophecies. Some revealed to him the true measurements of the Temple of Solomon, others told him how to exorcise demons. I must confess that I've never heard them speak." They had very mobile faces. The king looked at the queen tenderly. "Our host told me that one morning he found the blue youth who had escaped somehow from his prison attempting to break the seal of the maiden's vessel. But he was out of his element, could not breathe, and they saved him just in time, returning him to his liquid." "Terrible," the Otolevi said. "I wouldn't want such a responsibility. You'd have to take the vessels with you everywhere and find all that manure wherever you went. And then what would you do in the summer, on vacation? Leave them with the doorman?" "But perhaps," Allier concluded, "they are only Cartesian imps, or automata."
"The devil," Garamond said. "Dr. Allier, you're opening a whole new universe to me. We should all be more humble, my dear friends. There are more things in heaven and earth. But after all, à la guerre, comme à la guerre."
Garamond was awestruck. Diotelevi maintained an expression of cynical curiosity. Belbo showed no feeling at all. To dispel my doubt, I said to him, "Too bad Lorenza didn't come. She would have loved this." Yes, he replied absently. So Lorenza hadn't come. And I was the way Amparo had been in Rio. I was ill. I felt somehow cheated. They hadn't brought me the agogo. I left the group and went back into the building, picking my way through the crowd. I passed the buffet, drank something cool, though I was afraid it might contain a filter. I looked for a bathroom to splash cold water on my temples and neck. This accomplished, I again felt better. But as I came out, I saw a circular staircase, and, suddenly curious, I was unable to resist the new adventure. Perhaps, even though I thought I had recovered, I was still looking for Lorenza. Chapter 60. "Poor idiot, are you so foolish as to believe we will openly teach you the greatest and most important of secrets? I assure you that anyone who attempts to study, according to the ordinary and literal sense of their words, what the Hermetic philosophers write, will soon find himself in the twists of a labyrinth from which he will be unable to escape, having no Ariadne's thread to lead him out." Artephius. Descending, I came to a room below the ground, dimly lighted, with walls in rocaille like those of fountains in a park. In one corner I saw an opening like the bell of a trumpet. I heard sounds coming from it. When I approached, the sounds became more distinct until I could catch sentences as clear and precise as if they were being uttered at my side. An ear of Dionysius. Evidently the ear communicated with one of the upper rooms, picking up the conversation of those who stood near its aperture. "Signora, I'll tell you something I've never told anyone else. I'm tired. I've worked with cinnabar, with mercury. I sublimated spirits, did distillations with salts of iron, fermentations, and I still haven't found the stone. I prepared strong waters, corrosive waters, burning waters, all in vain. I used eggshells, sulfur, vitriol, arsenic, sal ammoniac, quartz, alkalis, oxides of rock, saltpeter, soda, salt of tartar, and potash alum. Believe me, do not trust them. Avoid the imperfect metals. Otherwise you will be deceived as I was deceived. I tried everything. Blood, hair, the soul of Saturn, marcasites, East Eustum, saffron of Mars, tincture of iron, litharge, antimony. To no avail. I extracted water from silver, calcified silver both with and without salt, and using aqua vitae, I extracted corrosive oils. I employed milk, wine, curds, the sperm of the stars which falls to earth, chelidon, placentas, ashes, even? Signora, there's nothing in this world that demands more caution than the truth. To tell the truth is like leeching one's own heart.
Enough, enough. You've got me all excited.
I dare confess my secret only to you. I am of no place and no era. Beyond time and space, I live my eternal existence. There are beings who no longer have guardian angels. I am one of them.
But why have you brought me here?
Another voice. My dear Balsamo, playing with the myth of immortality, eh?
Idiot. Immortality is not a myth. It's a fact.
I was about to leave, bored by this chatter, when I heard Salon. He was speaking in a whisper, tensely, as if gripping someone by the arm. I also recognized the voice of Pierre.
Come now, Salon was saying. Don't tell me that you too are here for this alchemical foolishness. And don't tell me you came to enjoy the cool air of the gardens. Did you know that after Heidelberg, Co accepted an invitation from the King of France to supervise the cleaning of Paris?
Les façades?
He wasn't Malraux. It must have been the sewers. Curious, isn't it? The man invented symbolic orange groves and apple orchards for emperors, but what really interested him were the underground passages of Paris. In the Paris of those days, there wasn't an actual network of sewers. It was a combination of canals on the surface, and below, conduits, about which little was known. The Romans, from the time of the Republic, knew everything about their Cloaca Maxima, yet 1,500 years later in Paris people were ignorant of what went on beneath their feet. Co accepted the king's invitation because he wanted to find out. What did he find out? After Co, Colbert sent prisoners down to clean the conduits. That was the pretext, and bear in mind that this was also the period of the man in the iron mask. But they escaped through the excrement, followed the current to the Seine, and sailed off in a boat, because nobody had the courage to confront those wretches covered with stinking slime and swarms of flies. Then Colbert stationed gendarmes outside the various openings of the sewer, and the prisoners, forced to stay in the passages, died. In 3 centuries, the city engineers managed to map only 3 kilometers of sewers. But in the 18th century there were 26 kilometers of sewers, and on the very eve of the Revolution. Does that suggest anything to you?
Ah, you know, new people were coming to power, and they knew something their predecessors didn't. Napoleon sent teams of men down into the darkness, through the detritus of the capital. Those who had the courage to work there found many things. Gold, necklaces, jewels, rings, God knows what else that had fallen into those passages. Some bravely swallowed what they found, then came out, took a laxative, and became rich. It was discovered that many houses had cellar trapdoors that led directly to the sewer.
Ça alors?
In a period when people emptied chamber pots out the window? And why did they have sewers with sidewalks along them, and iron rings set in the wall to hang on to?
These passages were the equivalent of those tapis francs, where the lowlife gathered, the pègre, as it was called then, and if the police arrived they could escape and resurface somewhere else.
Légende!
You think so? Whom are you trying to protect? Under Napoleon III, Baron Haussmann required all the houses of Paris by law to construct an independent cesspool, then an underground corridor leading to the sewer system. A tunnel 2 meters, 30 centimeters high, and 1.5 meters wide. You understand? Every house in Paris was to be connected by an underground corridor to the sewers. And you know the extent of the sewers of Paris today? 2,000 kilometers, and on various levels. And it all began with the man who designed those gardens in Heidelberg.
So?
I see you do not wish to talk. You know something, but you won't tell me.
Please, leave me. It's late. I am expected at a meeting.
A sound of footsteps. I didn't understand what Salon was getting at. Pressed against the rocaille by the ear, I looked around and felt that I was underground myself, and it seemed to me that the mouth of that phonergic channel was but the beginning of a descent into dark tunnels that went to the center of the earth, tunnels alive with Nibelungs. I felt cold. I was about to leave when I heard another voice. Come, we're ready to begin. In the secret chamber. Call the others. Chapter 61. The Golden Fleece is guarded by a 3-headed dragon, whose first head derives from the waters, whose second head derives from the earth, and whose third head derives from the air. It is necessary that these three heads belong to a single and very powerful dragon, who will devour all other dragons. Jean d'Espagnier, Arcanum Hermeticae Philosophiae Opus, 1623-138. I found my group again and told Allier I had overheard something about a meeting.
Aha, Allier said. What curiosity.
But I understand. Having ventured into the hermetic mysteries, you want to find out all about them. Well, as far as I know, this evening there is the initiation of a new member of the ancient and accepted Order of the Rosy Cross.
Can we watch? Garamond asked.
You can't. You mustn't. You shouldn't. But we'll act like those characters in the Greek myth who gazed upon what was forbidden them to see, and we'll risk the wrath of the gods. I'll allow you one peek. He led us up a narrow stairway to a dark corridor, drew aside a curtain, and through a sealed window we could glance into the room below, which was lighted by burning braziers. The walls were covered with lilies embroidered on damask, and at the far end stood a throne under a gilded canopy. On one side of the throne was a sun, on the other a moon, both set on tripods and cut out of cardboard or some plastic material, crudely executed, covered with tin foil or some metal leaf, gold and silver, of course, but effective, because each luminary spun, set in motion by the flames of a brazier. Above the canopy, an enormous star hung from the ceiling, shining with precious stones, or bits of glass. The ceiling was covered with blue damask, spangled with great silver stars. Before the throne was a long table decorated with palms. A sword had been placed on it, and between throne and table stood a stuffed lion, its jaws wide. Someone must have put a red light bulb inside the head, because the eyes shone, incandescent, and flames seemed to come from the throat. This, I thought, must be the work of Signor Salon, remembering the odd customers he had referred to that day in the Munich coal mine. At the table was Bramante, decked out in a scarlet tunic and embroidered green vestments, a white cape with gold fringe, a sparkling cross on his chest, and a hat vaguely resembling a mitre, decorated with a red and white plume. Before him, hieratically deployed, were about 20 men, also in scarlet tunics, but without vestments. On their chests they all wore a gold medal that I thought I recognized. I remembered a Renaissance portrait, the big Habsburg nose, and the curious lamb with legs dangling, hanging by the waist. They had adorned themselves with imitations, not bad, of the Order of the Golden Fleece. Bramante was speaking, his arms upraised as if uttering a litany, and the others responded from time to time. Then Bramante raised the sword, and from their tunics the others drew stilettos, or paper knives, and held them high. At this point Allier lowered the curtain. We had seen too much. We stole away with the tread of the Pink Panther, as Diotalevi put it. He was remarkably abreast of the perversions of popular culture, and found ourselves back in the garden, slightly breathless. Garamond was overwhelmed.
But are they masons?
And what, Allier replied, does a mason mean? They are the adepts of a chivalric order inspired by the Rosicrucians, and indirectly by the Templars.
But what does that have to do with the Masons? Garamond asked again.
If what you saw has anything in common with the Masons, it's the fact that Bramante's rite is also a pastime for provincial politicians and professional men. It was thus from the beginning. Freemasonry was a weak exploitation of the Templar legend, and this is the caricature of a caricature. Except that those gentlemen take it extremely seriously. Alas, the world is teeming with Rosicrucians and Templars like the ones you saw this evening. You mustn't expect any revelation from them, though among their number occasionally you can come across an initiate worthy of trust. But you, after all, Belbo said, without irony, as if the matter concerned him personally, spend time with them. Which ones do you believe in? Or did you once believe in?
None, of course. Do I look like a credulous individual?
I consider them with the cold objectivity, the understanding, the interest with which a theologian might observe a Naples crowd shouting in anticipation of the miracle of San Gennaro. The crowd bears witness to a faith, a deep need, and the theologian wanders among the sweating, drooling people because he might encounter there an unknown saint, the bearer of a higher truth, a man capable of casting new light on the mystery of the Most Holy Trinity. But the Holy Trinity is one thing, San Gennaro is another. He could not be pinned down. I didn't know how to define it. Hermetic skepticism? Liturgical cynicism? This higher disbelief that led him to acknowledge the dignity of all the superstitions he scorned.
It's simple, he was saying to Belbo. If the Templars, the real Templars, did leave a secret and did establish some kind of continuity, then it is necessary to seek them out. And to seek them in the places where they could most easily camouflage themselves, perhaps by inventing rites and myths in order to move unobserved, like fish in water. What do the police do when they seek the arch-villain, the evil mastermind? They dig into the lower depths, the notorious dives filled with petty crooks who will never conceive the grandiose crimes of the dark genius the police are after. What does the terrorist leader do to recruit new acolytes? Where does he look for them and find them? He circulates in the haunts of the pseudo-subversives, the fellow travelers who would never have the courage to be the real thing, but who openly ape the attitudes of their idols. Concealed light is best sought in fires, or in the brush where, after the blaze, the flames go on brooding under twigs, under trampled muck. What better hiding place for the true Templar than in the crowd of his caricatures? Chapter 62. We consider societies druidic if they are druidic in their titles or their aims, or if their initiations are inspired by druidism. M. Rouault, Les Druides, Les Sociétés Initiatiques Celtes Contemporaines, Paris, Rocher, 1983, page 18. Midnight was approaching, and according to Allier's program, the second surprise of the evening awaited us. Leaving the Palatine Gardens, we resumed our journey through the hills. After we had driven 3/4 of an hour, Allier made us park the 2 cars at the edge of a wood. We had to cross some underbrush, he said, to arrive at a clearing, and there were neither roads nor trails. We proceeded, picking our way through shrubs and vines, our shoes slipping on rotted leaves and slimy roots. From time to time, Allier switched on a flashlight to find a path, but only for a second, because, he said, we should not announce our presence to the celebrants. Theo Talevi made a remark, I don't recall it exactly, something about Little Red Riding Hood, and Allier, with tension in his voice, asked him to be quiet. As we were about to come to the end of the brush, we heard voices. We had reached the edge of the clearing, which was illuminated by a glow from remote torches, or perhaps votive lights, flickering at ground level, faint and silvery, as if a gas were burning with chemical coldness in bubbles drifting over the grass. Allier told us to stop where we were, still shielded by bushes, and wait. In a little while the priestesses will come, the druidesses, that is. This is an invocation of the great cosmic virgin Michael. Saint Michael is a popular Christian adaptation, and it's no accident that he is an angel, hence androgynous, hence able to take the place of a female divinity. Where do they come from? Theo Talevi whispered. From many places. Normandy, Norway, Ireland. It is a very special event, and this is a propitious place for the rite. Why? Garamond asked. Certain places have more magic than others. But who are they in real life? People, secretaries, insurance agents, poets, people you might run into tomorrow and not recognize. Now we could see a small group preparing to enter the clearing. The phosphorescent light, I realized, came from little lamps the priestesses held up in their hands. They had seemed earlier to be at ground level because the clearing was on the top of a hill. The druidesses had climbed up from below and were approaching the flat, open hilltop. They were dressed in white tunics, which fluttered in the slight breeze. They formed a circle. In the center, 3 celebrants stood. Those are the 3 Hallowins of Lisieux, Clan MacNoise, and Pino Torinese, Allier said. Belbo asked why those 3 in particular. Allier shrugged and said, No more. We must wait now in silence. I can't summarize for you in a few words the whole ritual and hierarchy of Nordic magic. Be satisfied with what I can tell you. If I do not tell you more, it is because I do not know, or am not allowed to tell. I must respect certain vows of privacy. In the center of the clearing I noticed a pile of rocks, which suggested a dolmen. Perhaps the clearing had been chosen because of the presence of those boulders. One of the celebrants climbed up on the dolmen and blew a trumpet. Even more than the trumpet we had seen a few hours earlier, this looked like something out of the triumphal march in Aida, but a muffled and nocturnal sound came from it, as if from far away. Belbo touched my arm. It's the ramsing, the horn of the thugs around the sacred banyan. My reply was cruel, because I didn't realize he was joking precisely to repress other associations, and it must have twisted the knife in the wound. It would no doubt be less magical with the bombardon, I said. Belbo nodded. Yes, they're here precisely because they don't want a bombardon, he said. Was it on that evening he began to see a connection between his private dreams and what had been happening to him in those months? Allier hadn't followed our words, but he heard us whispering. It's not a warning or a summons, he explained, but a kind of ultrasound to establish contact with the subterranean currents. You see, now the druidesses are all holding hands in a circle. They are creating a kind of living accumulator to collect and concentrate the telluric vibrations. Now the cloud should appear. What cloud? I whispered. Tradition calls it the green cloud. Wait. I didn't really expect a green cloud. Almost immediately, however, a soft mist rose from the ground. A fog, I would have said, if it had been thicker, more homogeneous. But it was composed of flakes, denser in some places than in others. The wind stirred it, raised it in puffs, like spun sugar. Then it moved with the air to another part of the clearing where it gathered. A singular effect. For a moment you could see the trees in the background, then they would be hidden in a whitish steam, while the turf of the center of the clearing would smoke and further obscure our view of whatever was going on, as the moonlight shone around the concealed area. The flake cloud shifted suddenly, unexpectedly, as if obeying the whims of a capricious wind. A chemical trick, I thought, but then I reflected, we were at an altitude of about 600 meters, and it was possible that this was an actual cloud. Foretold by the rite? Summoned? Or was it just that the celebrants knew that on that hilltop, under favorable conditions, those erratic banks of vapor formed just above the ground? It was difficult to resist the fascination of the scene. The celebrants' tunics blended with the white of the cloud, and their forms entered and emerged from that milky obscurity as if it had spawned them. There was a moment when the cloud filled the entire center of the little meadow. Some wisps, rising, separating, almost hid the moon, but the clearing was still bright at its edges. We saw a druidess come from the cloud and run toward the wood, crying out, her arms in front of her. I thought she had discovered us and was hurling curses, but she stopped within a few meters of us, changed direction, and began running in a circle around the cloud, disappearing in the whiteness to the left, only to reappear after a few minutes from the right. Again she was very close to us, and I could see her face. She was a sibyl, with a great Dantean nose over a mouth thin as a cicatrix, which opened like a submarine flower, toothless, but for two incisors and one skewed canine. The eyes were shifty, hawk-like, piercing. I heard, or thought I heard, or think now that I remember hearing, but I may be superimposing other memories, a series of Gaelic words mixed with evocations in a kind of Latin, something on the order of O Pegnia, O Io, et Iu Ulema. Suddenly the fog lifted, disappeared, the clearing became bright again, and I saw that it had been invaded by a troop of pigs, their short necks encircled by garlands of green apples. The druidess who had blown the trumpet, still atop the dolmen, now brandished a knife. "We go now," Allier said sharply. "It's over." I realized as I heard him that the cloud was above us and around us, and I could barely make out my companions. "What do you mean, over?" Guermont said. "Looks to me like the real stuff is just beginning." "What you were permitted to see is over. Now it is not permitted. We must respect the rite. Come." He re-entered the wood, was promptly swallowed by the mist that enfolded us. We shivered as we moved, slipping on dead leaves, panting in disarray like a fleeing army, and regrouped at the road. We could be in Milan in less than 2 hours. Before getting back into Guermont's car, Allier said goodbye to us. "You must forgive me for interrupting the show for you. I wanted you to learn something, to see the people for whom you are now working, but it was not possible to stay. When I was informed of this event, I had to promise I wouldn't disturb the ceremony. Our continued presence would have had a negative effect on what follows." "And the pigs? What happens to them?" Belbo asked. "What I could tell you, I have told you." Chapter 63. "What does the fish remind you of?" "Other fish." "And what do other fish remind you of?" "Other fish." Joseph Heller, Catch 22, New York, Simon & Schuster, 1961, Roman 27. I came back from Piedmont with much guilt, but as soon as I saw Leah again, I forgot the desires that had grazed me. Still, our expedition left other marks on me, and now it troubles me that at the time I wasn't troubled by them. I was putting in final order, chapter by chapter, the illustrations for the wonderful adventure of metals, but once again I could not elude the demon of resemblance any more than I had been able to in Rio. How was this Réaumur cylindrical stove, 1750, different from this incubator chamber for eggs, or from this 17th-century Athanor, maternal womb, dark uterus for the creation of God knows what mystic metals? It was as if they had installed the Deutsches Museum in the Piedmont castle I had visited the week before. It was becoming harder for me to keep apart the world of magic and what today we call the world of facts. Men I had studied in school as bearers of mathematical and physical enlightenment now turned up amid the murk of superstition, for I discovered they had worked with one foot in Kabbalah and the other in the laboratory. Or was I rereading all history through the eyes of our diabolicals? But then I would find texts above all suspicion that told me how in the time of positivism physicists barely out of the university dabbled in seances and astrological cenacles, and how Newton had arrived at the law of gravity because he believed in the existence of occult forces, which recalled his investigations into Rosicrucian cosmology. I had always thought that doubting was a scientific duty, but now I came to distrust the very masters who had taught me to doubt. I said to myself, I am like Amparo. I don't believe in it, yet I surrender to it. Yes, I caught myself marveling over the fact that the height of the Great Pyramid really was 1/1,000,000,000th of the distance between the Earth and the Sun, and that you really could draw striking parallels between Celtic and Amerind mythologies. And I began to question everything around me, the houses, the shop signs, the clouds in the sky, and the engravings in the library, asking them to tell me not their superficial story, but another deeper story, which they surely were hiding, but finally would reveal, thanks to the principle of mystic resemblances. Leah saved me, at least temporarily. I told her everything, or almost, about the trip to Piedmont, and evening after evening I came home with curious new bits of information to add to my file of cross-references. She said, "Eat, you're thin as a rail." One evening she sat beside me at the desk. With her hair parted in the middle of her brow, she could now look straight into my eyes. She had her hands in her lap, a housewifely pose. I had never seen her sit like that before, her legs wide, skirt taut from knee to knee. An inelegant position, I thought, but then I saw her face, radiant, slightly flushed. I listened to her, though I didn't yet know why, with respect. "Pow," she said, "I don't like what's happening to you with this minutiae business. First you collected facts the way people collect seashells. Now it's as if you were marking down lottery numbers." "I just enjoy myself more with the diabolicals." "It's not enjoyment, it's passion. There's a difference. Be careful, they'll make you sick." "Now, don't exaggerate. They're the sick ones, not I. You don't go crazy because you work in an asylum." "That remains to be seen." "You know, I've always been suspicious of analogies, but now I find myself at a great feast of analogies, a Coney Island, a Moscow May Day, a Jubilee year of analogies, and I'm beginning to wonder if by any chance there isn't a reason." "I've seen your files, pal," Leah said to me, "because I have to keep them in order. Whatever your diabolicals have discovered is already here. Take a good look." And she patted her belly, her thighs, her forehead. With her spread legs drawing her skirt tight, she sat like a wet nurse, solid and healthy, she so slim and supple, with a serene wisdom that illuminated her and gave her a matriarchal authority. "Pal, archetypes don't exist. The body exists. The belly inside is beautiful because the baby grows there, because your sweet cock, all bright and jolly, thrusts there, and good tasty food descends there, and for this reason the cavern, the grotto, the tunnel are beautiful and important, and the labyrinth too, which is made in the image of our wonderful intestines. When somebody wants to invent something beautiful and important, it has to come from there, because you also came from there the day you were born, because fertility always comes from inside a cavity, where first something rots and then, lo and behold, there's a little man, a date, a baobab. And high is better than low, because if you have your head down, the blood goes to your brain, because feet stink and hair doesn't stink as much, because it's better to climb a tree and pick fruit than end up underground, food for worms, and because you rarely hurt yourself hitting something above. You really have to be in an attic, while you often hurt yourself falling. That's why up is angelic and down is devilish. But because what I said before about my belly is also true, both things are true. Down and inside are beautiful, and up and outside are beautiful, and the spirit of Mercury and Manichaeanism have nothing to do with it. But because what I said before about my belly is also true, both things are true. Down and inside are beautiful, and up and outside are beautiful, and the spirit of Mercury and Manichaeanism have nothing to do with it. Fire keeps you warm and cold, gives you bronchial pneumonia, especially if you're a scholar 4,000 years ago, and therefore fire has mysterious virtues besides its ability to cook your chicken. But cold preserves that same chicken, and fire, if you touch it, gives you a blister this big. Therefore, if you think of something preserved for millennia like wisdom, you have to think of it on a mountain, up, high, and high is good, but also in a cavern, which is good too, and in the eternal cold of the Tibetan snows, best of all. And if you then want to know why wisdom comes from the Orient and not from the Swiss Alps, it's because the body of your ancestors in the morning, when it woke and there was still darkness, looked to the east, hoping the sun would rise and there wouldn't be rain. Yes, Mama. Yes, indeed, my child. The sun is good because it does the body good, and because it has the sense to reappear every day. Therefore, whatever returns is good, not what passes and is done with. The easiest way to return from where you've been without retracing your steps is to walk in a circle. The animal that coils in a circle is the serpent. That's why so many cults and myths of the serpent exist, because it's hard to represent the return of the sun by the coiling of a hippopotamus. Furthermore, if you have to make a ceremony to invoke the sun, it's best to move in a circle, because if you go in a straight line, you move away from home, which means the ceremony will have to be kept short. The circle is the most convenient arrangement for any rite. Even the fire-eaters in the marketplace know this, because in a circle, everybody can see the one who's in the center, whereas if a whole tribe formed a straight line, like a squad of soldiers, the people at the ends wouldn't see. And that's why the circle and rotary motion and cyclic return are fundamental to every cult and every rite. Yes, Mama. We move on to the magic numbers your authors are so fond of. You are one and not two. Your cock is one and my cunt is one, and we have one nose and one heart. So you see how many important things come in ones. But we have two eyes, two ears, two nostrils, my breasts, your balls, legs, arms, buttocks. Three is the most magical of all because our body doesn't know that number. We don't have three of anything, and it should be a very mysterious number that we attribute to God wherever we live. But if you think about it, I have one cunt and you have one cock. Shut up and don't joke. And if we put these two together, a new thing is made and we become three. So you don't have to be a university professor or use a computer to discover that all cultures on Earth have ternary structures, trinities. But two arms and two legs make four, and four is a beautiful number when you consider that animals have four legs and little children go on all fours, as the Sphinx knew. We hardly have to discuss five, the fingers of the hand, and then with both hands you get that other sacred number, 10. There have to be 10 commandments, because if there were 12, when the priest counts 1, 2, 3, holding up his fingers, and comes to the last two, he'd have to borrow a hand from the sacristan. Now, if you take the body and count all the things that grow from the trunk, arms, legs, head, and cock, you get 6. But for women, it's 7. For this reason, it seems to me that among your authors, 6 is never taken seriously, except as the double of 3, because it's familiar to the males who don't have any 7. So when the males rule, they prefer to see 7 as the mysterious sacred number, forgetting about women's tits, but what the hell? 8. Give me a minute. If arms and legs don't count as one apiece but 2, because of elbows and knees, you have 8 parts that move. Add the torso and you have 9, add the head and you have 10. Just sticking with the body, you get all the numbers you want. The orifices, for example. The orifices? Yes, how many holes does the body have? I counted. Eyes, nostrils, ears, mouth, ass. 8. You see? Another reason 8 is a beautiful number. But I have 9, and with that 9th, I bring you into the world, therefore 9 is holier than 8. Or, if you like, take the anatomy of your menhir, which your authors are always talking about, standing up during the day, lying down at night. Your thing, too. No, don't tell me what it does at night. The fact is that erect it works and prone it rests. So the vertical position is life, pointed sunward, and obelisks stand as trees stand, while the horizontal position and night are sleep, death. All cultures worship menhirs, monoliths, pyramids, columns, but nobody bows down to balconies and railings. Did you ever hear of an archaic cult of the sacred banister? You see? And another point. If you worship a vertical stone, even if there are a lot of you, you can all see it. But if you worship instead a horizontal stone, only those in the front row can see it, and the others start pushing, "Me too, me too," which is not a fitting sight for a magical ceremony.
But rivers...
Rivers are worshipped not because they're horizontal, but because there's water in them, and you don't need me to explain to you the relation between water and the body. Anyway, that's how we're put together, all of us, and that's why we work out the same symbols millions of kilometers apart, and naturally they all resemble one another. Thus you see that people with a brain in their head, if they're shown an alchemist's oven all shut up and warm inside, think of the belly of the mama making a baby. And only your diabolicals think that the Madonna about to have the child is a reference to the alchemist's oven. They spent thousands of years looking for a message, and it was there all the time. They just had to look at themselves in the mirror.
You always tell me the truth. You are my mirrored me, myself seen by you. I want to discover all the secret archetypes of the body.
That evening we inaugurated the expression, discovering archetypes, to indicate our moments of greatest intimacy. I was half asleep when Leah touched my shoulder.
"I almost forgot," she said. "I'm pregnant."
I should have listened to Leah. She spoke with the wisdom of life and birth, venturing into the underground passages of Agartha, into the pyramid of Isis unveiled. We had entered Gevurah, the Sephira of fear, the moment in which wrath manifests itself in the world. I had let myself be seduced by the thought of Sophia. Moses Cordovero says that the female is to the left, and all her attributes point to Gevurah, unless the male, using these attributes, adorns his bride and causes her to move to the right, toward good. Every desire must remain within its limits, otherwise Gevurah becomes judgment, the dark appearance, the universe of demons. To discipline desire. This I had done in the Tenda de Umbanda. I had played the agogo, I had taken an active part in the spectacle, and I had escaped the trance. I had done the same with Leah. I had regulated desire out of homage to the bride, and I had been rewarded in the depths of my loins. My seed had been blessed. But I was not to persevere. I was to be seduced by the beauty of Tiferet.